16. Yes, he was the one who fueled the rumors after that. I could never have done what he himself did, convincing and persuading the world that he was indeed the hero. I don't know if he himself believed it, but he made others think that he must be the one.
Vin rarely used her quarters. Elland had assigned her spacious rooms, which was perhaps part of the problem. She'd spent her childhood sleeping in nooks, lairs, or alleys. Having three separate chambers was a bit daunting. It didn't really matter, however. During her time awake, she was with either Elland or the Mists. Her rooms existed for her to sleep in, or in this case, for her to make a mess in. She sat on the floor in the center of her main chamber. Ellen's steward, concerned that Vin didn't have any furniture, had insisted on decorating her rooms. This morning, Vin had pushed some of this aside, bunching up rugs and chairs on one side so that she could sit on the cool stones with her book. It was the first real book she had ever owned, though it was just a collection of pages bound loosely at one side. That suited her just fine. The simple binding had made the book that much easier to pull apart. She sat amid stacks of paper. It was amazing how many pages there were in the book, once she had separated them. Vin sat next to one pile, looking over its contents. She shook her head, then crawled over to another pile. She leafed through the pages, eventually selecting one. "Sometimes I wonder if I'm going mad," the words read. "Perhaps it is due to the pressure of knowing that I must somehow bear the burden of an entire world. Perhaps it is caused by the death I have seen, the friends I have lost, the friends I have been forced to kill. Either way, I sometimes see shadows following me, dark creatures that I don't understand, nor do I wish to understand. They are perhaps some figment of my overtaxed mind." Vin sat for a moment rereading the paragraphs. Then she moved the sheet over to another pile. Orsieur lay on the side of the room, head on paws, eyeing her. "Mistress," he said, as she set down the page, "I have been watching you work for the last 2 hours, and will admit that I am thoroughly confused. What is the point of all this?" Vin crawled over to another stack of pages. "I thought you didn't care how I spent my time."
"I don't," Orsieur said, "but I do get bored."
"And annoyed, apparently."
"I like to understand what is going on around me."
Vin shrugged, gesturing toward the stacks of paper.
"This is the Lord Ruler's logbook. Well, actually, it's not the logbook of the Lord Ruler we knew, but the logbook of the man who should have been the Lord Ruler."
"Should have been?" Orsior asked.
"You mean he should have conquered the world, but didn't?"
"No," Vin said. "I mean he should have been the one who took the power at the Well of Ascension. This man, the man who wrote this book, we don't actually know his name, was some kind of prophesied hero. Or, everyone thought he was. Anyway, the man who became the Lord Ruler, Rashik, was this hero's pack-man. Don't you remember us talking about this, back when you were imitating Renu?" Orsior nodded.
"I recall you briefly mentioning it."
"Well, this is the book Kelsier and I found when we infiltrated the Lord Ruler's palace. We thought it was written by the Lord Ruler, but it turns out it was written by the man the Lord Ruler killed, the man whose place he took."
"Yes, mistress," Orsior said. "Now why exactly are you tearing it to pieces?"
"I'm not," Vin said. "I just took off the binding so I could move the pages around. It helps me think."
"I see," Orsier said. "And what exactly are you looking for? The Lord Ruler is dead, mistress. Last I checked, you killed him."
"What am I looking for?" Vin thought, picking up another page. "Ghosts in the mist."
She read the words on this page slowly. "It isn't a shadow. The dark thing that follows me, the thing that only I can see, it isn't really a shadow. It is blackish and translucent,
but it doesn't have a shadow-like solid outline. It's insubstantial, wispy and formless, like it's made out of black fog. Or mist, perhaps.
Vin lowered the page.
It watched him, too, she thought. She remembered reading the words over a year before, thinking that the hero must have started to go mad. With all the pressures on him, who would have been surprised? Now, however, she thought she understood the nameless logbook author better. She knew he was not the Lord Ruler, and could see him for what he might have been. Uncertain of his place in the world, but forced into important events. Determined to do the best he could. Idealistic, in a way. And the mist spirit had chased him. What did it mean? What did seeing it imply for her?
She crawled over to another pile of pages. She'd spent the morning scanning through the logbook for clues about the mist creature. However, she was having trouble digging out much beyond these two familiar passages. She made piles of pages that mentioned anything strange or supernatural. She made a small pile with pages that referenced the mist spirit. She also had a special pile for references to the deepness. This last one, ironically, was both the largest and least informative of the group. The logbook author had a habit of mentioning the deepness, but not saying much about it. The deepness was dangerous, that much was clear. It had ravaged the land, slaying thousands. The monster had sown chaos wherever it stepped, bringing destruction and fear, but the armies of mankind had been unable to defeat it. Only the Terrace prophecies and the Hero of Ages had offered any hope.
If only he had been more specific, Vin thought with frustration, riffling papers.
However, the tone of the logbook really was more melancholy than it was informative. It was something that the hero had written for himself, to stay sane, to let him put his fears and hopes down on paper. Elland said he wrote for similar reasons sometimes. To Vin, it seemed a silly method of dealing with problems. With a sigh, she turned to the last stack of papers, the one with pages she had yet to study. She lay down on the stone floor and began to read, searching for useful information. It took time. Not only was she a slow reader, but her mind kept wandering. She'd read the logbook before, and oddly, hints and phrases from it reminded her of where she'd been at the time. 2 years and a world away in Feliz, still recovering from her near death at the hands of a steel inquisitor, she'd been forced to spend her days pretending to be Valette Renew, a young, inexperienced country noblewoman. Back then, she still hadn't believed in Kelsier's plan to overthrow the final empire. She'd stayed with the crew because she valued the strange things they offered her. Friendship, trust, and lessons in allomancy, not because she accepted their goals. She would never have guessed where that would lead her. To balls and parties, to actually growing, just a bit, to become the noblewoman she had pretended to be. But that had been a farce, a few months of make-believe. She forced her thoughts away from the frilly clothing and the dances. She needed to focus on practical matters.
And is this practical? She thought idly, setting a page in one of the stacks. Studying things I barely comprehend, fearing a threat nobody else even cares to notice?
She sighed, folding her arms under her chin as she lay on her stomach. What was she really worried about? That the deepness would return? All she had were a few phantom visions in the mist, things that could, as Elland implied, have easily been fabricated by her overworked mind. More important was another question. Assuming that the deepness was real, what did she expect to do about it? She was no hero, general, or leader.
Oh, Kelsier, she thought, picking up another page. We could use you now.
Kelsier had been a man beyond convention, a man who had somehow been able to defy reality. He'd thought that by giving his life to overthrow the Lord Ruler, he would secure freedom for the Ska. But what if his sacrifice had opened the way for a greater danger? Something so destructive that the Lord Ruler's oppression was a preferable alternative. She finally finished the page, then placed it in the stack of those that contained no useful information. Then she paused. She couldn't even remember what she'd just read. She sighed, picking the page back up, looking at it again. How did Elland do it? He could study the same books over and over again. But for Vin, it was hard to... She paused. I must assume that I am not mad, the words said. I cannot, with any rational sense of confidence, continue my quest if I do not believe this. The thing following me must, therefore, be real. She sat up. She only vaguely remembered this section of the logbook. The book was organized like a diary, with sequential but dateless entries. It had a tendency to ramble, and the hero had been fond of droning on about his insecurities. This section had been particularly dry. But there, in the middle of his complaining, was a tidbit of information. I believe that it would kill me if it could, the text continued. There is an evil to the thing of shadow and fog, and my skin recoils at its touch. Yet it seems limited in what it can do, especially to me. It can affect this world, however. The knife it placed in Fedek's chest proves that much. I'm still not certain which was more traumatic for him, the wound itself or seeing the thing that did it to him. Rashik whispers that I stabbed Fedek myself, for only Fedek and I can give witness to that night's events. However, I must make a decision. I must determine that I am not mad. The alternative is to admit that it was I who held that knife. Somehow, knowing Rashik's opinion on the matter makes it much easier for me to believe the opposite. The next page continued on about Rashik, and the next several entries contained no mention of the mist spirit. However, Vin found even these few paragraphs exciting. He made a decision, she thought. I have to make the same one. She'd never worried that she was mad, but she had sensed some logic in Ellen's words. Now she rejected them. The mist spirit was not some delusion brought on by a mixture of stress and memories of the logbook. It was real. That didn't mean the deepness was returning, nor did it mean that Luthadel was in any sort of supernatural danger. Both, however, were possibilities. She set this page with the two others that contained concrete information about the mist spirit, then turned back to her studies, determined to pay closer attention to her reading. The armies were digging in. Elland watched from atop the wall as his plan, vague though it was, began to take form. Straff was making a defensive perimeter to the north, holding the canal route back a relatively short distance to Urto, his home city and capital. Set was digging in to the west of the city, holding the Luth-Davin Canal, which ran back to his cannery in Haverfrex. A cannery. That was something Elland wished he had in the city. The technology was newer, perhaps 50 years old, but he'd read of it. The scholars had considered its main use that of providing easily carried supplies for soldiers fighting at the fringes of the Empire. They hadn't considered stockpiles for sieges, particularly in Luthadel. But then, who would have? Even as Elland watched, patrols began to move out from the separate armies. Some moved to watch the boundaries between the two forces, but others moved to secure other canal routes, bridges across the river channel, and roads leading away from Luthadel. In a remarkably short time, the city felt completely surrounded, cut off from the world and the rest of Ellen's small kingdom. No more moving in or out. The armies were counting on disease, starvation, and other weakening factors to bring Elland to his knees. The siege of Luthadel had begun. That's a good thing, he told himself. For this plan to work, they have to think me desperate. They have to be so sure that I'm willing to side with them that they don't consider that I might be working with their enemies, too. As Elland watched, he noticed someone climbing up the steps to the wall. Clubs. The general hobbled over to Elland, who had been standing alone.
Congratulations, Clubs said. Looks like you now have a full-blown siege on your hands.
Good.
It'll give us a little breathing room, I guess, Clubs said. Then he eyed Elland with one of his gnarled looks. You'd better be up to this, kid.
I know, Elland whispered.
You've made yourself the focal point, Clubs said. The Assembly can't break this siege until you meet officially with Straff. and the kings aren't likely to meet with anyone on the crew other than yourself. This is all about you. Useful place for a king to be, I suppose. If he's a good one.
Clubs fell silent. Elland stood, looking out over the separate armies. The words spoken to him by Tyndall, the terrace woman, still bothered him.
You are a fool, Elland Venture.
So far, neither of the kings had responded to Elland's requests for a meeting, though the crew was sure that they soon would. His enemies would wait, to make Elland sweat a bit. The assembly had just called another meeting, probably to try and bully him into releasing them from their earlier proposal. Elland had found a convenient reason to skip the meeting. He looked at Clubs.
And am I a good king, Clubs? In your opinion?
The general glanced at him, and Elland saw a harsh wisdom in his eyes.
I've known worse leaders, he said. But I've also known a hell of a lot better.
Elland nodded slowly.
I want to be good at this, Clubs. Nobody else is going to look after the Ska like they deserve. Set, Straff. They just make slaves of the people again. I want to be more than my ideas, though. I want to... need to be a man that others can look to.
Clubs shrugged.
My experience has been that the man is usually made by the situation. Kelsier was a selfish dandy until the pits nearly broke him.
He glanced at Elland.
Will this siege be your pits of Hathsin, Elland Venture?
I don't know, he said honestly.
Then we'll have to wait and see, I guess. For now, someone wants to speak with you.
He turned, nodding toward the street some 40 feet below, where a tall, feminine figure stood in colorful terrace robes.
She told me to send you down, Club said.
He paused, then glanced at Elland.
It isn't often you meet someone who feels like they can order me around, and a terrace woman at that. I thought those terrace were all docile and kindly.
Elland smiled. I guess Sazed spoiled us. Club snorted.
So much for 1,000 years of breeding, eh?
Elland nodded.
You're sure she's safe?
Clubs asked.
Yes, Elland said. Her story checks out.
Vin brought in several of the terrace people from the city, and they knew and recognized Tyndall. She's apparently a fairly important person back in her homeland. Plus, she had performed ferrochemy for him, growing stronger to free her hands. That meant she wasn't a Chondra. All of it together meant that she was trustworthy enough. Even Vin admitted that, even if she continued to dislike the terrace woman. Clubs nodded to him and Elland took a deep breath. Then he walked down the stairs to meet Tyndall for another round of lessons.
Today, we will do something about your clothing, Tyndall said, closing the door to Elland's study.
A plump seamstress with bowl-cut white hair waited inside, standing respectfully with a group of youthful assistants. Elland glanced down at his clothing. It actually wasn't bad. The suit coat and vest fit fairly well. The trousers weren't as stiff as those favored by imperial nobility, but he was king now. Shouldn't he be able to set the trends?
I don't see what's wrong with it, he said.
He held up a hand as Tyndall began to speak.
I know it's not quite as formal as what other men like to wear, but it suits me. It's disgraceful, Tyndall said. Now I hardly see... Don't argue with me. But see, the other day you said that... Kings don't argue, Elland Venture, Tyndall said firmly. They command. And part of your ability to command comes from your bearing. Slovenly clothing invites other slovenly habits, such as your posture, which I've already mentioned, I believe.
Elland sighed, rolling his eyes as Tyndall snapped her fingers. The seamstress and her assistants started unpacking a pair of large trunks.
This isn't necessary, Elland said. I already have some suits that fit more snugly. I wear them on formal occasions. You're not going to wear suits anymore, Tyndall said. Excuse me?
Tyndall eyed him with a commanding stare, and Elland sighed.
Explain yourself, he said, trying to sound commanding.
Tyndall nodded.
You have maintained the dress code preferred by the nobility, sanctioned by the final emperor. In some respects, this was a good idea. It gave you a connection to the former government, and made you seem less of a deviant. Now, however, you are in a different position. Your people are in danger, and the time for simple diplomacy is over. You are at war. Your dress should reflect that.
The seamstress selected a particular costume, then brought it over to Elland, while the assistants set up a changing screen. Elland hesitantly accepted the costume. It was stiff and white, and the front of the jacket appeared to button all the way up to a rigid collar. All in all, it looked like a uniform, he said, frowning.
Indeed, Tyndall said. You want your people to believe that you can protect them? Well, a king isn't simply a lawmaker. He's a general. It is time you began to act like you deserve your title, Elland Venture.
I'm no warrior, Elland said. This uniform is a lie.
The first point we will soon change, Tyndall said. The second is not true. You command the armies of the Central Dominance. That makes you a military man, whether or not you know how to swing a sword. Now, go change.
Elland acceded with a shrug. He walked around the changing screen, pushed aside a stack of books to make room, then began to change. The white trousers fit snugly and fell straight around the calves. While there was a shirt, it was completely obscured by the large, stiff jacket, which had military shoulder fittings. It had an array of buttons, all of which he noticed were wood instead of metal, as well as a strange shield-like design over the right breast. It seemed to have some sort of arrow, or perhaps spear, emblazoned in it. Stiffness, cut, and design considered, Elland was surprised how well the uniform fit. It's sized quite well, he noted, putting on the belt, then pulling down the bottom of the jacket, which came all the way to his hips.
We got your measurements from your tailor, Tyndall said.
Elland stepped around the changing screen, and several assistants approached. One politely motioned for him to step into a pair of shiny black boots, and the other attached a white cape to fastenings at his shoulders. The final assistant handed him a polished hardwood dueling cane and sheath. Elland hooked it onto the belt, then pulled it through a slit in the jacket so it hung outside. That much, at least, he had done before.
Good,
Tyndall said, looking him up and down.
Once you learn to stand up straight, that will be a decent improvement. Now sit.
Elland opened his mouth to object, but thought better of it. He sat down, and an assistant approached to attach a sheet around his shoulders. She then pulled out a pair of shears.
Now wait, Elland said. I see where this is going.
Then voice an objection, Tyndall said. Don't be vague.
All right then, Elland said. I like my hair.
Short hair is easier to care for than long hair, Tyndall said. And you have proven that you cannot be trusted in the area of personal grooming.
You aren't cutting my hair, Elland said firmly.
Tyndall paused, then nodded. The apprentice backed away, and Elland stood, pulling off the sheet. The seamstress produced a large mirror, and Elland walked forward to inspect himself. And froze. The difference was surprising. All his life he'd seen himself as a scholar and socialite, but also as just a bit of a fool. He was Elland, the friendly, comfortable man with the funny ideas. Easy to dismiss, perhaps, but difficult to hate. The man he saw now was no dandy of the court. He was a serious man, a formal man, a man to be taken seriously. The uniform made him want to stand up straighter, to rest one hand on the dueling cane. His hair, slightly curled, long on the top and sides, and blown loose by the wind atop the city wall, didn't fit. Elland turned.
All right, he said. Cut it.
Tyndall smiled, then nodded for him to sit. He did so, waiting quietly while the assistant worked. When he stood again, his head matched the suit. It wasn't extremely short, not like Ham's hair, but it was neat and precise. One of the assistants approached and handed him a loop of silver-painted wood. He turned to Tyndall, frowning.
"A crown?" he asked. "Nothing ostentatious," Tyndall said. "This is a more subtle era than some of those gone by. The crown isn't a symbol of your wealth, but of your authority. You will wear it from now on, whether you are in private or in public."
"The Lord Ruler didn't wear a crown."
"The Lord Ruler didn't need to remind people that he was in charge," Tyndall said.
Elland paused, then slipped on the crown. It bore no gemstones or ornamentation. It was just a simple coronet. As he might have expected, it fit perfectly. He turned back toward Tyndall, who waved for the seamstress to pack up and leave.
"You have 6 uniforms like this one waiting for you in your rooms," Tyndall said. "Until this siege is over, you will wear nothing else. If you want variety, change the color of the cape."
Elland nodded. Behind him, the seamstress and her assistants slipped out the door.
"Thank you," he told Tyndall. "I was hesitant at first, but you are right. This makes a difference." "Enough of one to deceive people for now, at least," Tyndall said.
"Deceive people?"
"Of course. You didn't think that was it, did you?"
"Well," Tyndall raised an eyebrow.
"A few lessons, and you think you're through? We've barely begun. You are still a fool, Elland Venture. You just don't look like one anymore. Hopefully our charade will begin reversing some of the damage you've done to your reputation. However, it's going to take a lot more training before I'll actually trust you to interact with people and not embarrass yourself."
Elland flushed. "What do you..." He paused. "Tell me what you plan to teach me, then."
"Well, you need to learn how to walk, for one thing."
"Something's wrong with the way I walk?"
"By the forgotten gods, yes," Tyndall said,
sounding amused, though no smile marred her lips.
"And your speech patterns still need work. Beyond that, of course, there is your inability to handle weapons."
"I've had some training," Elland said. "Ask Vin. I rescued her from the Lord Ruler's palace the night of the collapse."
"I know," Tyndall said. "And from what I've heard, it was a miracle you survived. Fortunately, the girl was there to do the actual fighting. You apparently rely on her quite a bit for that sort of thing."
"She's Mistborn."
"That is no excuse for your slovenly lack of skill," Tyndall said. "You cannot always rely on your woman to protect you. Not only is it embarrassing, but your people, your soldiers, will expect you to be able to fight with them. I doubt you will ever be the type of leader who can lead a charge against the enemy, but you should at least be able to handle yourself if your position gets attacked."
"So you want me to begin sparring with Vin and Ham during their training sessions?"
"Goodness, no! Can't you imagine how terrible it would be for morale if the men saw you being beaten up in public?"
Tyndall shook her head.
"No. We'll have you trained discreetly by a dueling master. Given a few months, we should have you competent with the cane and the sword. Hopefully, this little siege of yours will last that long before the fighting starts."
Elland flushed again.
"You keep talking down to me. It's like I'm not even king in your eyes. Like you see me as some kind of placeholder."
Tyndall didn't answer, but her eyes glinted with satisfaction.
"You said it, not I," her expression seemed to say.
Elland flushed more deeply.
"You can, perhaps, learn to be a king, Elland Venture," Tyndall said. "Until then, you'll just have to learn to fake it."
Elland's angry response was cut off by a knock at the door. Elland gritted his teeth, turning.
"Come in."
The door swung open.
"There's news," Captain Demus said,
his youthful face excited as he entered. He froze. Ellen cocked his head.
"Yes?"
I,
Demu paused, looked Elland over again before continuing.
Ham sent me, Your Majesty. He says that a messenger from one of the kings has arrived.
Really? Elland said. From Lord Set?
No, Your Majesty. The messenger is from your father.
Elland frowned. Well, tell Ham I'll be there in a moment.
Yes, Your Majesty, Demu said, retreating. I like the new uniform, Your Majesty.
Thank you, Demu, Elland said. Do you by chance know where Lady Vin is? I haven't seen her all day.
I think she's in her quarters, Your Majesty.
Her quarters? She never stays there. Is she sick?
Do you want me to summon her? Demu asked.
No, thank you, Elland said. I'll get her. Tell Ham to make the messenger comfortable.
Demu nodded, then withdrew. Elland turned to Tyndall, who was smiling to herself with a look of satisfaction. Elland brushed by her, walking over to grab his notebook.
I'm going to learn to do more than just fake being king, Tyndall.
We'll see.
Elland shot a glance at the middle-aged terrace woman in her robes and jewelry.
Practice expressions like that one, Tyndall noted, and you just might do it.
Is that all it is, then? Elland asked. Expressions and costumes? Is that what makes a king?
Of course not.
Elland stopped by the door, turning back.
Then what does? What do you think makes a man a good king, Tyndall of Terrace?
Trust,
Tyndall said, looking him in the eyes.
A good king is one who is trusted by his people, and one who deserves that trust.
Elland paused, then nodded. Good answer, he acknowledged, then pulled open the door and rushed out to find Vin.